Blog Talk Radio.
We are the world.
God bless you tonight. This is the Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Movement. We want to say to the King family, we lost Dexter, Dr. King's son. Dexter died, and we're praying for that Dr. Martin Luther King family. But in the spirit of Dr. Martin Luther King's 95th birthday, this was his 95th birthday, and some asked me, Bishop, what would Dr. King be saying in 2024? The first thing Dr. King would say, stop the killing, save the babies. The second thing Dr. King would say, we have to stop the violence all over the world. And black folks in particular have to understand they are somebody and set back for a comeback. And I want to tell you, wherever you might be tonight, your setback is set for a comeback. Sister Peaches, I was just thinking about you tonight. And I was thinking about you, Sister Nett, come a long ways. But God's still going to reestablish you. And I'm praying for Sister Margaret also. In the spirit of Mother Rosie Cook, in the spirit of Mother Carrie Nunn, these are women in the spirit realm that see that things go forth. Psalm 44, put this down. Psalm 44, Psalm 64, Psalm 59, and Psalm 51. And as you read that, it's going to give you a sense of understanding where we are, where we should be, and what's happening in South Africa many years ago and what's happening here. When we look at what's happening across the length breadth of this country, we must say, stop the war in Israel. Over 30,000 people being killed. That's war crimes. Over in Russia, that's war crimes. Let's step up to the plate and deal with the violence that's going on in America. You like to get killed here that you're in the war zone. We're in the midst of three wars right now. The one in Russia, in Israel, and there's going to be another one over in the Middle East. And this bringing about change. Change that we must change as citizens and stop destroying each other. You know, the spirit of Dr. King said nonviolent because the word was, through Dr. Abernathy and Dr. King, that if we go into a war confrontation, we would destroy ourselves and scorn other people. We are dealing with a white America, a black America, and we're dealing with a Native American America. We were already here. So it's important tonight for you to look beyond and say to the Almighty God that we come this far by faith. But I want to say to you tonight, we got a long ways to go. We got a long ways to go to deal with the crime, the rape, the killing, the murder that's going on in this country. And even with the politicians are so crooked that they won't deal with the reality. Black folks was brought to this country in handcuffs and chains and told them that they wasn't first-class citizens. Your grandmother, my grandmother, our ancestor, I say our ancestor. But we were set back for a comeback. And this year, 2024 is a comeback. 2025 is a comeback to justice, truth, and the reality. I'm praying for those that got loved ones that passed on and seem like you can't make it, lost a mother, sister, brother, cousin, or whatever. In all their ways, acknowledge God, and he will direct your path. Prophet Johnson used to say that all the time. In all their ways, acknowledge God, he will direct your path. And sometimes I feel Dr. Johnson, Prophet Johnson, just walk in the queue and say, my people, if they just listen to that word, if my people that are called by my name humble themselves and pray and turn from their wicked ways, God will heal the land. And some of you asked them why I'm going through so much. Prayer changes things. And before we get started, this is the Dr. Martin Luther King Show tonight. We're praying for the King family, Dexter, Dr. King's son. When Dr. King passed, he was 7 years old. And he was running the Martin Luther King Center. And Sister Brandy, she runs the nonprofit center. But the King family had been through a lot. And prayer changed things. We got evil people, but we got people that is a God. I want to pray for you that having headaches and pain. I want to pray for you tonight that you lost on dope, on drugs. You lost a loved one, lost a son. The lady called me and said she lost her son. Then she lost her other son. So she, and then the family where the young man killed the mama, the sisters, the brothers, because they are strung out on the devil drugs. They own crack, cocaine, and anything else they can bring in this country. We got a long ways to go, people. And I just want to share with you tonight, God is available to heal your body. Let me say it again. God is available to deliver you out of what you're in. God is developed tonight and able to touch you and bring you out. In the spirit of Dr. King, who was the ambassador of justice and truth, and we're going to listen to him after I pray, because South Africa is a part of us. You know, some of us were already here, and some our ancestors brought him. Arkansas, Mississippi, Louisiana. Father God, we come tonight. God, we come to ask you to bless every family. God, we come tonight to ask you for every dough. We might not have been so right, but give us of our sin. Somebody need a healing. Somebody need a touch in their body right now. Move that high blood condition, that heart condition, that stroke condition. The young man on drugs don't know he in the world. The young woman don't know she in the world. The God of Abraham, the God of Jacob, the God of our ancestors, I call on you tonight to be a guide for our nation. Be a guide for the president. Be a guide for the governor. Be a guide for the mayor. And bless Brother Trump. They all fighting him, but I'm lifting him up tonight. Whatever he's going through, God, put your hands around Trump and let him be a winner, not a loser. We come tonight because all the people over in Israel, 130 that was murdered, and that's a shame. Thousands, not really. And that's genocide in itself. That's a war crime. And what happened, that's a war crime, what happened over in Russia. And the killing of those three blacks in their beds sleeping, the bomb at night come and killed them. I'm asking you to let God touch you tonight. I'm asking tonight for doors to open up for you, the God of Abraham, the God of Jacob. I want you to get ready for 2024 to be a miracle breakthrough for you. Debt-free house, debt-free car. And whatever you need, God going to establish you. I'm praying for you, you and you. I'm praying for you, Sister Lily. I'm praying for you, Sister Lisa. Lorraine, I'm praying for you, all is well. LaWanda, I'm praying for you. Joanne, I'm praying for you. I want you to know, Sister April, I'm praying for you. I want to tell you, Mary Hawkins, I'm praying for you. And I want to tell you, Tanya Scott, Mary Scott, I'm praying for you. Every letter, every telephone call is an expression of love. I want to leave this with you. Set back for a comeback. And you tell them, I'm back. I'm back because I'm bad. I'm back because God and his saints and his angels is with me. When Prophet Johnson said, in all thy ways acknowledge God, he will direct your path to another level as you ask God for healing. Some of you drop out and you get tired. I know a lot of people call me from Detroit and ask me what happened to Detroit. They lost. They lost because somebody wasn't directing them in the right way. You got to be knowing that you're corrected by God. I'm praying for you, Sister Jean. I'm praying for you, Sister Ralph. And I'm praying for you, Brother Henry. I'm praying for you, Brother Joe. Every Lisa, I'm praying for you. I claim your healing tonight. And whatever you need, God got what you need. We're praying for the King family tonight. Lord Dexter, and they lost their brother, their sister, their grandmother. They've been through a lot. But prayer changes things. And whatever God do, he's going to do it quick, fast, and in a hurry. Let's hear from Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.
In the United States, and before taking my seat, talk about some of the larger struggles in the whole world, and some of the more difficult struggles in places like South Africa. But that is a desperate, poignant question on the lips of people all over our country and all over the world. I get it almost everywhere I go and almost every press conference. It is a question of whether we are making any real progress in the struggle to make racial justice a reality in the United States of America? And whenever I seek to answer that question, on the one hand, I seek to avoid an undue pessimism. On the other hand, I seek to avoid the superficial optimism. And I try to incorporate or develop what I consider a realistic position by admitting on the one hand that we have made many significant strides over the last few years in the struggle for racial justice, but by admitting that before the problem is solved, we still have numerous things to do and many challenges to meet. And it is this realistic position that I would like to use as a basis for our thinking together tonight as we think about the problem in the United States. We have come a long way, but we have a long way to go before the problem is solved. Now let us notice first that we've come a long way, and I would like to say at this point that the Negro himself has come a long way in reevaluating his own intrinsic worth. Now, in order to illustrate this, a little history is necessary. It was in the year 1619 when the first Negro slaves landed on the shores of America. And they were brought there from the soils of Africa. Unlike the Pilgrim Fathers who landed at Plymouth a year later, they were brought there against their will. And throughout slavery, the Negro was treated in a very inhuman fashion. He was a thing to be used, not a person to be respected. The United States Supreme Court rendered a decision in 1857 known as the Dred Scott decision, which well illustrated this whole idea and which well illustrated what existed at that time. But in this decision, the Supreme Court of the United States said in substance that the Negro is not a citizen of the United States. He is merely property subject to the dictates of his owner. And it went on to say that the Negro has no right that the white man is bound to respect. This was the idea that prevailed during the days of slavery. With the growth of slavery, it became necessary to give some justification for it. You know, it seems to be a fact of life that human beings cannot continue to do wrong without eventually reaching out for some thin rationalization to clothe an obvious wrong in the beautiful garments of righteousness. And this is exactly what happened during the days of slavery. There were those who even misused the Bible and religion to give some justification for slavery and to crystallize the patterns of the status quo. And so it was argued from some pulpits that the Negro was inferior by nature because of Noah's curse upon the children of Ham. And then the Apostle Paul's dictum became a watchword, servants be obedient to your master. One brother had probably read the logic of the great philosopher Aristotle. You know, Aristotle did a great deal to bring into being what we now know as formal logic in philosophy. An informal logic that is a big word known as the syllogism, which has a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion. And so this brother decided to put his argument for the inferiority of the Negro in the framework of an Aristotelian syllogism. He could say all men are made in the image of God. This was the major premise. Then came the minor premise. God, as everybody knows, is not a Negro. Therefore, the Negro is not a man. This was the kind of reasoning that prevailed. Well, living with the conditions of slavery and then later segregation, many Negroes lost faith in themselves. Many came to feel that perhaps they were less than human. Many came to feel that they were inferior. This, it seems to me, is the greatest tragedy of slavery, the greatest tragedy of segregation, not merely what it does to the individual physically, but what it does to one psychologically. It scars the soul of the segregated as well as the segregator. It gives the segregator a false sense of superiority while leaving the segregated with a false sense of inferiority. This is exactly what happened. Then something happened to the Negro. Circumstances made it possible and necessary for him to travel more. The coming of the automobile, the upheavals of two world wars, the Great Depression. And so his rural plantation background gradually gave way to urban industrial life. His economic life was gradually rising through the growth of industry, the development of organized labor and expanded educational opportunities. Even his cultural life was gradually rising through the steady decline of crippling illiteracy. All of these forces conjoined to cause the Negro in America to take a new look at himself. Negro masses all over began to reevaluate themselves. And then something else happened along with all of this. The Negro in the United States turned his eyes and his mind to Africa. He noticed the magnificent drama of independence taking place on the stage of African history. And noticing the developments, and noticing what was happening, and noticing what was being done on the part of his black brothers and sisters in Africa, gave him a new sense of dignity in the United States and a new sense of self-respect. The Negro came to feel that he was somebody. His religion revealed to him that God loves all of his children and that all men are made in his image. And that the basic thing about a man is not his specificity, but his fundamentum. Not the texture of his hair or the color of his skin, but his eternal dignity and worth. And so the Negro in America could now cry out unconsciously with the eloquent voice, fleecy locks and black complexion cannot forfeit nature's claim. Skin may differ, but affection dwells in black and white the same. Were I so tall as to reach the pole or to grasp the ocean at a span, I must be measured by my soul. The mind is the standard of the man. And with this new sense of dignity and this new sense of self-respect, a new Negro came into being with a new determination to suffer, to struggle, to sacrifice, and even to die if necessary in order to be free. And this reveals that we have come a long, long way since 1619. But if we're to be true to the facts, it is necessary to say that not only has the Negro re-evaluated his own intrinsic worth, the whole nation has come a long, long way in extending the frontiers of civil rights. And I'd like to mention just a few things that have happened in our country which reveal this. 50 years ago, or even 25 years ago, a year hardly passed when numerous Negroes were not brutally lynched by some vicious mob. Fortunately, lynchings have about ceased today. If one would go back to the turn of the century, you would find that in the southern part of the United States, you had very few Negroes registered to vote. By 1948, that number had leaped to about 750,000. In 1960, it had leaped to 1,200,000. When we went into the presidential election just a few weeks ago, that number had leaped to more than 2 million. We went into that election with more than 2 million Negroes registered to vote in the South, which meant that we in the civil rights movement, by working hard, have been able to add more than 800,000 new Negroes as registered voters in the last 3 years. This reveals that we've made strides. And then when we look at the question of economic justice, as much to do, but we can at least say that some strides have been made. The average Negro wage earner who is employed today in the United States earns 10 times more than the average Negro wage earner of 12 years ago. The national income of the Negro is now a little better than $28 billion a year, which is all more than all of the exports of the United States and more than the national budget of Canada. This reveals that we have made some strides in this area. But probably more than anything else, and you've read about it so much here and all over the world, I'm sure, we have noticed a gradual decline, even demise, of the system of racial segregation. Now, the legal history of racial segregation had its beginning in 1896. Many people feel that racial segregation has been a reality in the United States a long, long time, but the fact is that this was a rather recent phenomenon in our country, just a little better than 60 years old. And it had its legal beginning with a decision known as the Plessy versus Ferguson decision, which said in substance that separate but equal facilities could exist, and it made the doctrine of separate but equal the law of the land. We all know what happened as a result of the old Plessy doctrine. There was always a strict enforcement of the separate, without the slightest intention to abide by the equal. And the Negro ended up being plunged into the abyss of exploitation, where he experienced the bleakness of nagging injustice. But then something marvelous happened. The Supreme Court of our nation in 1954 examined the legal body of segregation, and on May 17th of that year, pronounced it constitutionally dead. It said in substance that the old Plessy doctrine must go, that separate facilities are inherently unequal, and that to segregate a child on the basis of his race is to deny that child equal protection of the law. And so we've seen many changes since that momentous decision was rendered in 1954. It came as a great beacon light of hope to millions of disinherited people all over our nation. Then something else happened, which brought joy to all of our hearts. It happened this year. It was last year after the struggle in Birmingham, Alabama, that the late President Kennedy came to realize that there was a basic issue that our country had to grapple with, with a sense of concern and a sense of immediacy. He made a great speech a few days before, well, it was really on the same day that the University of Alabama was to be integrated, and Governor Wallace stood in the door and tried to block that integration. When Mr. Kennedy had to have the National Guard federalized, he stood before the nation and said in eloquent terms, "The problem which we face in the area of civil rights is not merely a political issue. It is not merely an economic issue. It is at bottom a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and as modern as the Constitution. It is a question of whether we will treat our Negro brothers as we ourselves would like to be treated. And on the heels of that great speech, he went and recommended to the Congress of our nation the most comprehensive civil rights bill ever recommended by any president of our great nation. Fortunately, after many months of battle, for a period we got a little tired of that. You know, there are some men in our country who like to talk a lot. Maybe you've read about the filibuster. And you know, they get bogged down in the paralysis of analysis. And they will just go on and on and on. And they wanted to talk that bill to death. President Lyndon Johnson got to work. He started calling congressmen and senators in. He started meeting day in and day out with influential people in the country, making it clear that that bill had to pass as a tribute to the late President Kennedy, but also as a tribute to the greatness of the country and as an expression of its dedication to the American dream. And it was that great day last summer that that bill came into being. It was on July 2nd that Mr. Johnson signed that bill, and it became the law of the land. And so in America now, we have a civil rights bill, and I'm happy to report to you that by and large, that bill is being implemented in communities all across the South. We have seen some surprising levels of compliance, even in some communities in the state of Mississippi. And whenever you can find anything right in Mississippi, things are getting better. So we've come a long, long way since 1896. Now, this would be a wonderful place for me to end my speech. First, it would mean making a relatively short speech, and that would be a magnificent accomplishment for a Baptist preacher. Second, it would mean that the problem is about solved. And you know, it would be wonderful if I could go around the world. I wish I could. And if I could go around America and talk about this problem as a problem that once existed, but that no longer has existence. I wish I could do that. But you know, if I stop at this point, I will merely be stating a fact and not telling the truth. You see, a fact is merely the absence of contradiction, but truth is the presence of coherence. Truth is the relatedness of facts. Now, it's a fact that we've come a long, long way, but it isn't the whole truth. In order to get the whole truth, we've got to add the other side. And I'm afraid if I stop at this point, I will leave you, my dear friends of London, the victims of a dangerous optimism. If I stop here, I'll leave you the victims of an illusion wrapped in superficiality. So in order to tell the truth, it's necessary to move on and say, not only have we come a long, long way, but we have a long, long way to go before the problem is solved. Now, I don't think I need to stay on this point very long. You read the newspapers, you look at your televisions, you know what's happening. You know what is happening on an almost day-to-day basis. I mentioned the fact that lynchings have about ceased, but other things are happening. We are not unmindful of the fact, and we cannot forget it. That just last year, four little children were murdered in Birmingham, Alabama, in the Church of God on Sunday morning. Thank you. I'm very happy to hear from my good friend up there. I continue to speak. I can talk a little louder than you can. Now, on the other issue. We can never forget the fact that just this summer, three civil rights workers were brutally murdered near Philadelphia, Mississippi. All of this reveals to us that we have not achieved the level of brotherhood. We have not achieved the brotherhood that we need and that we must have in our nation. We still have a long, long way to go. I mentioned voter registration, and the fact that we have been able to add about 800,000 new registered voters in the last 2 or 3 years, the fact that it's over 2 million now, I guess that sounded like real progress, and it does represent some progress. But let me give you the other side, and that is the fact that there are still more than 10 million Negroes living in the southern part of the United States, and some 6 million the Negroes living in the southern part of the United States are of voting age, and yet only 2 million are registered. And this means that 4 million remain unregistered, not merely because they are apathetic, not because they are complacent. This may be true of some few, but because all types of conniving methods are still being used to keep Negroes from becoming registered voters. Complex literacy tests are given, which make it almost impossible for anybody to pass the test, even if he has a PhD degree in any field or a law degree from the best law schools of the world. And then actual economic reprisals are often taken out against Negroes who seek to register and vote in some of the Black Belt counties of Mississippi and Alabama and other places. And then some are actually faced with physical violence and sometimes physical death. This reveals that we have a great deal that must be done in this area. I mentioned economic justice, and I'm sure that that figure, $28 billion, sounded very large. That's a lot of money. But then I must go on and give you the other side, if I'm to be honest about the picture. That is the fact that 42% of the Negro families of the United States still earn less than $2,000 a year, while just 16% of the white families earn less than $2,000 a year. 21% of the Negro families of America earn less than $1,000 a year, while just 5% of the white families earn less than $1,000 a year. Then we face the fact that 88% of the Negro families of America earn less than $5,000 a year, while just 58% of the white families earn less than $5,000 a year. So we can see that that is still a great gulf between the haves, so to speak, and the have-nots. And if America is to continue to grow and progress and develop, move on toward its greatness, this problem must be solved. Now, this economic problem is getting more serious because of many forces alive in our world and in our nation. For many years, Negroes were denied adequate educational opportunities. For many years, Negroes were even denied apprenticeship training. And so the forces of labor and industry so often discriminated against Negroes. This meant that the Negro ended up being limited by and large to unskilled and semi-skilled labor. Now, because of the forces of automation and cybernation, these are the jobs that are now passing away. And so the Negro wakes up in a city like Detroit, Michigan, and discovers that he's 28% of the population and about 72% of the unemployed. Now, in order to grapple with that problem, our federal government will have to develop massive retraining programs, massive public works programs, so that automation can be a blessing, as it must be, to our society and not a curse. Then the other thing, when we think of this economic problem, we must think of the fact that there is nothing more dangerous than to build a society with a segment in that society which feels that it has no stake in the society. Nothing more dangerous than to build a society with a number of people who see life as little more than a long and desolate corridor with no exit sign. They end up with despair because they have no jobs, because they can't educate their children, because they can't live in a nice home, because they can't have adequate health facilities. We always hear of the various reasons why and the various myths concerning integration and why integration shouldn't come into being. But those people who argue against integration at this point often say, well, if you integrate the public schools, for instance, you will pull the white race back a generation. And they like to talk about the cultural lag in the Negro community. And then they go on to say, now, you know, the Negro is a criminal, and he has the highest crime rate in any city that you can find in the United States. And the arguments go on ad infinitum, why integration shouldn't come into being. But I think there's an answer to that. That is that if there is cultural lag in the Negro community, and there certainly is, this lag is there because of segregation and discrimination. It's there because of long years of slavery and segregation. Criminal responses are not racial, but environmental. Poverty, economic deprivation, social isolation, and all of these things breed crime, whatever the racial group may be. And it is a torturous logic to use the tragic results of racial segregation as an argument for the continuation of it. It is necessary to go back.
You are listening to the newly discovered Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speech at the City Temple Hall in London on Monday evening, 7:30 p.m., December 7th, 1964. For more information about this recording or other recordings of Dr. Martin Luther King, please visit Pacifica Radio Archives or call us
in the United States, in South Africa, or anywhere else. You've got to wait on time. And I know they've said to us so often in the States and to our allies in the white community, just be nice and be patient and continue to pray, and in 100 or 200 years, the problem will work itself out. We've heard and we've lived with the myth of time. The only answer that I can give to that myth is that time is neutral. It can be used either constructively or destructively. And I must honestly say to you that I'm convinced that the forces of ill will have often used time much more effectively than the forces of goodwill. And we may have to repent in this generation. Not merely for the vitriolic words and the violent actions of the bad people, but for the appalling silence and indifference of the good people who sit around saying, wait on time. Somewhere along the way, it is necessary to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. And so we must help time, and we must realize that the time is always right to do right. This is so vital, and this is so necessary. Now, the other myth that gets around a great deal in our nation, and I'm sure in other nations of the world, is the idea that you can't solve the problems in the realm of human relations through legislation. You can't solve the housing problem and the job problem and all of these other problems through legislation. You've got to change the heart. We had a presidential candidate just recently who spoke about this a great deal, and I think Mr. Goldwater sincerely believed that you couldn't do anything through legislation because he voted against everything in the Senate, including the Civil Rights Bill. And he said all over the nation throughout the election that we don't need legislation, that legislation can't deal with this problem. But he was nice enough to say that you've got to change the heart. Now, I want to at least go halfway with Brother Goldwater at that point. I think he's right. If we're going to get this problem solved in America and all over the world, ultimately, people must change their hearts where they have prejudices. If we're going to solve the problems facing mankind, I would be the first to say that every white person must look down deep within and remove every prejudice that may be there, and come to see that the Negro the colored peoples generally must be treated right, not merely because the law says it, but because it is right and because it is natural. I agree with this 100%. And I'm sure that if the problem is to be solved ultimately, men must be obedient not merely to that which can be enforced by the law, but they must rise to the majestic heights of being obedient to the unenforceable. But after saying all of that, I must go on to the other side. This is where I must leave Mr. Goldwater and others who believe the legislation has no place. It may be true that you can't legislate integration, but you can legislate desegregation. It may be true that morality cannot be legislated, but behavior can be regulated. It may be true that the law can't change the heart, but it can restrain the heartless. It may be true that the law can make a man love me, but it can restrain him from lynching me, and I think that's pretty important also. So while legislation may not be able to change the hearts of men, it does change the habits of men. And when you change the habits, pretty soon the attitudes and the hearts will be changed. And so that is a need, a continual basis for meaningful legislation to grapple with.
If you're making a to-do list today, make it easy on yourself. Just write down Reese's. Then write down, eat them. Run.
I have to finish it.
Sometime. Thank you.
Thank you.